On this, the 200th episode of the Open Paddock podcast, we start our extravaganza off with a greeting from you from Sean. That's right, he's not here. Tonight we're going to talk IndyCar. We've got Mazda Road to Indy, Formula One, and Rally all coming to you on this, the 200th episode of the Open Paddock podcast.
Higher performance and faster and more reliable.
You are listening to the Open Paddock Podcast, bringing you the finest in rally, Formula One, IndyCars, Mazda Road to Indy, sports cars, and other news from all around the world of motorsports. Now, here is your hosts, Sean, Mike, Doug, Mike, and Kevin. And that's the show, everybody. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Wow,
this is the last show that we were doing.
So. I forgot that we were already at 200. Holy crap. Didn't we just start doing this like last Christmas or something?
Something like that. The Open Paddock 200th episode extravaganza or something like that.
We should have like explodey fireworks and in John Philip Sousa music playing in the background.
I'm celebrating.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Mike. I'm celebrating OP style, sucking down a nice bit of rum.
Yes, I've poured myself a gin and tonic in a pint glass this evening and laced it with moonshine drunken cherries.
Drunken cherries. You are rolling much harder than I am, sir. I just went with just straight rum. You know, I kept it simple, but you know, you had to kick it up a notch. Bam!
Indeed. It's all for the podcast. I don't normally drink.
Yes,
you don't normally drink,
you don't
right?
Know, ladies and gentlemen that are listening, what you don't realize is that Michael is now wearing his gorilla suit while he's joining the
He's dipping ice cream bar in gin.
Do you have any Häagen-Dazs in Finlandia?
I'm going a little lighter still. I've got myself a classic Guinness, nice and chilled and delicious. A meal in a glass.
Fail! Don't chill, Guinness.
Yes, you do.
No, you don't. I'm Irish. I know how you drink Guinness, and you don't drink it chilled.
I disagree, but that's all right.
Hey, that's Douglas Patterson over there, enjoying his Guinness at room temperature.
Well, keep in mind, the room temperature in Ireland is about, 55, 60 degrees.
Maybe we should ask Peter Dempsey.
We call that root cellar temperature.
Maybe we could get Peter Dempsey to cover that topic on a blog sometime.
There you go.
That's right. I'm your host, Shimp, and that is Larry Moe and Curly joining me this week.
Yeah.
You'll notice that, what's his name? Sean. Sean. Yeah. Sorry, Sean. Sean's not with us tonight because he's being a responsible adult for once.
Hey, what the hell? Sean, the responsible one?
Yeah, who'd have thought?
This evening's special Open Paddock podcast is presented this evening without Sean interruption for your listening pleasure.
There'll be plenty of interruption for the rest of us.
I was almost expecting to be this evening's Open Paddock broadcast is brought to you by the letters A and A. And brought to you by the number 4 or something like that. Yeah, I think we've officially lost this show.
So yeah, let's go ahead. We need to move on to like topics or something.
Yeah,
that might be a little more worthwhile.
IndyCar report. Castroneves avoids injury in Brazil's stock car crash when Elio Castroneves smacks the wall in Brazil, slides along it, and head-ons a tire barrier.
Boy.
Yeah. Elio got a little bit banged up, some lacerations to his legs, needed some stitches. Pretty bad head injury and kind of whiplash type thing going on. But he was not allowed to continue in the event, even though I think he felt he could. The interesting thing about this is it happens right on the heels of the Tony Stewart deal. And you just start to wonder if some of these owners and sponsors are just kind of starting to get a little concerned about their drivers going off and racing and everything.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of the NFL, you know, in the stick and ball athletes, mm-hmm. very often have written into their contracts, you will not even so much as ride a motorcycle.
talking to you, Big Ben.
Yeah, but then
it's that restrictive.
But you know, you've got that. But then it's like we discussed with Charlie last week. You even have incidents like Joe Sakic did, where you are opening a knife and you cut your hand, and you miss games. But some of us are bigger than others.
That's a household risk that can happen to anybody. I mean, you walk up a flight of stairs and you could break your leg. But
anybody remember Neil O'Donnell that was the quarterback of the Jets when he missed an entire season with an ankle injury because he was trying to jump over a line on the field?
No, I missed that. But yeah, you're right. Some risks are better. You just have to, what are the odds? How much risk are you assuming? And I think, fixing supper with a chef's knife is an acceptable risk. Maybe rally racing when you're a Formula One driver is unacceptable. Maybe sprint car racing when you have your own NASCAR team and there's hundreds of employees dependent upon you. Maybe that's not acceptable. I don't know. And
one interesting thing that was brought to my attention was the fact that back when Tony was with Joe Gibbs Racing, he did a lot of late model racing. He didn't do any sprint car racing. One of the reasons he started his own team was so he could go sprint car racing. And had he been in a late model, he wouldn't be out with a broken leg.
Yeah. I mean, Tony Stewart has been, even when he was at Joe Gibbs, that's when he started his World of Outlaws team. That's when he started his USAC team. And occasionally, very occasionally, would race in those cars. More commonly in the winged car because they're considered to be a little bit safer than the non-winged cars. But, yeah.
He got more grip.
Well, more grip and more structure to absorb energy, say, in a roll. Yeah. So,
speaking of more grip, Fort Lauderdale's gained more grip in event planning.
Oh, there's one other thing I want to talk about on Castroneves, and it kind of dovetails right into
We're moving on.
The circuit that they were racing on was a brand new street circuit in Ribeirão Preto or something to that effect. Sorry for those who speak Portuguese and all that. Ribeirão Preto has been mentioned in the past as a brand new IndyCar venue. And
yeah, wasn't that the venue that was supposed to get the race before the Sao Paulo venue?
I don't know if it was before. I can't remember exactly the whole deal, but recall they've been talking about a second Brazil race, and I thought that was one of the venues that they were talking about, but maybe it was the first one. I can't remember for sure. I just find it interesting. That is Elio's hometown. So, anyway, and that dovetails nicely into Fort Lauderdale because, it's another venue that we're potentially looking at.
So, this would potentially be another venue that we could run very early or very late in the year, right?
Yeah.
Is that why they're looking at a second Florida event?
I would think that's definitely the case.
You'd almost have to do it on the backside of the schedule instead of the spring, because of the date equity that St. Petersburg already has.
Well, how far distant are those tracks from each other? Isn't Fort Lauderdale pretty far?
Now, ask Eddie Gossage about the distance and how relevant it is.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true.
According to Eddie, four hours is too close.
Yeah.
Now, according to Eddie, any other venue in the country is too much, unless it's Indy 2 weeks before his event.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that whole Eddie Gossage thing earlier, and the funny thing is right now in California, we have two races that are within an hour's drive of each other in Long Beach and Fontana.
And we're very seriously talking about adding maybe a Laguna Seca to the schedule as well.
Yeah.
Which is right down the road from Sonoma.
Indeed. Indeed. So I think there's potential, but a lot of this potential is coming from these warmer weather markets, from California, from Florida, and from Texas, because, hey, they're early season opportunities, and they're really looking at packing the beginning of the season with more races. Does that mean we're going to have a bunch of races all packed together down in Florida and, you know, do the Florida spin or whatever? I don't think that that's going to happen, but I could see you running Fort Lauderdale in February, March, and then coming back to St. Petersburg in April or early May.
You know, I don't think you're going to move the St. Petersburg race.
No, that's true.
You know,
that's
the date equity they have there in the last weekend of March is just too strong. But the nice thing about the California venues and the Florida venues is that they are not just good for early season or late season, although they are good for those. Mm-hmm. If you need to, you can stick a Fort Lauderdale in July or in August, something like that. You absolutely cannot do that in Texas.
Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Shouldn't. Let me say that you shouldn't do that in Texas.
It sounds like we'll be hearing something on this Fort Lauderdale deal soon, because they're talking about pressing it into service for 2014, or potentially getting everything lined up for 2015. Andretti has been. Am I right on that? Andretti's the one that's pushing to be the promoter for that event.
Yeah, that sounds right. Speaking of Andretti Promotions, IndyFest Milwaukee, the future is a little bit up in doubt about it, because sounds like IndyCar wants a sanctioning fee and Andretti doesn't want to do the race without a title sponsor.
It sounds like Andretti realizes they can't make it work unless they have that title sponsor.
Well, I mean, that's Andretti's problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I'm bummed that I missed this year's event, because I really think that the Andretti people did a great job with that event, much better than the Avocado folk who were in there before. And I was really excited that they got it back this year. And from what I hear, it was a very good event this year. But you know, when you look at it from just a straight up business point, it's their responsibility to get the funding and the promotion and all that lined up.
Yeah.
IndyCar is saying, hey, you know, if you want us to come, this is our fee. And you know, if they can't make it work, then we don't have Milwaukee. As much as that sucks, as you know, as much as all of us want Milwaukee on the schedule, you know, it's first got to be about the dollars.
Yeah, and that's Milwaukee's problem, is the dollars, because it's not a traditional venue. It's not the promoter dealing with the track he promotes for. It's a promoter dealing with the sanctioning fee from IndyCar and the lease from the State Fair Board.
Well, and the fact that the venue itself is kind of neutered from a promotion standpoint.
Yeah,
The lack of luxury boxes and all the regular hospitality amenities that you see at most other racetracks. Falcons.
Yeah, I mean, it has things going for it, but they need to use the facility better. Unfortunately, you know, the things it has going for it, it's smack dab in the middle of a state fairground. It's been years since they ran it as part of the state fair, and that would be huge if they could somehow manage to get it back with the state fair.
Oh, that would be excellent.
That's just not going to happen.
And moving on to, let's get into some driver news right now. First off, we've got Dale Coyne Racing announcing that Ryo Hirakawa is going to be in the number 18 entry at Sonoma coming up. He's 19 years old, and he is the reigning Japanese Formula 3 champion, and he currently sits 11th in the Super Formula that used to be Formula Nippon standings.
Banzai! I'm stoked. I'm really happy to have some fresh Japanese talent back in the series. I've always been a Sato fan, and before him Hideki Muto. Those of you, of course, who've been listening to the show since ever will know that
for 200 episodes.
For 200 episodes. All right. Well, it's when we first started this thing, I was a huge Hideki Muto fan, and back when he was in Lights, and so I've always really liked the Japanese drivers, even Kosuke Matsuura. Yes, I'll admit it. But
Matsushita wasn't so good. Or Matsushita, however you say it.
Oh yeah,
King Hiro.
He wasn't so good.
Yeah, we're not going to talk.
Unless we're talking Swift engineering, right?
Roger, yeah. Right. anyway, so no, this is good because of course Sato is he's not young. He's still got years left in him for sure, but he's not young. So it's nice to see some fresh Japanese representation in the series.
Speaking of fresh young talent coming in, today it was announced that Luca Filippi and J.R. Hildebrand will be splitting the 98 for the rest of the season at Brian Herta. Luca Filippi, you may know from 2011, finished second in GP2 Europe Series to Romain Grosjean. And of the 10 drivers of note that he faced in that series, 5 of them now drive Formula 1. J.R. Hildebrand, also in 2011, finished second at the Indianapolis 500, was the 2007, I want to say, or was no, it was 2010 Indy Lights champion, did some yes. A1 GP. I think it's a good move for Herta. It looks like they're trying to expand to a two-car operation for 2014. So more than likely, I believe you're looking at their driver lineup for 2014.
So are they splitting it road course ovals or
Hildebrand? Or Hildebrand gets Sonoma and Fontana. Filippi gets Baltimore and Houston.
Okay. So well, that makes sense because Hildebrand, California kid, would represent the bigger draw for their sponsors
with oval experience as well.
Yes. Big oval experience.
Let's see. Also,
just 200 laps.
Just do 199. Yeah, exactly. I was going the same place.
Now, for another bit for 2014 coming up, Tony Kanaan has a lot of options on the table. And, there's one little thing that happened today, actually, that I'm wondering if might put a kink into his plans a little bit. Did y'all hear about that? Do you know what I'm talking about? Juan Montoya will not be back in NASCAR for Ganassi next year.
Do you really think that Kanaan would go to NASCAR for Ganassi?
Nope, but I do think that Montoya would go to that fourth Ganassi car in IndyCar.
Really?
Possibly.
I don't know.
Possibly.
Would he still fit? Have you seen how he looks lately?
He's definitely been on the NASCAR diet.
You know, that was.
Sorry, man, but
I love his hot dogs.
Seen him lately.
Cheeseburgers. Loves McDonald's.
If Paul Tracy can wedge his fat rear into one of them, I'm sure we can shove Juan into one.
Grease him up. But no, I don't know. I have a hard time seeing Juan Pablo in an Indy car.
I think Juan Pablo goes S car racing.
I would agree with that.
I
think that's a very likely scenario. And you know, one of the things that wouldn't shock me is if Ganassi decided to run a P2 car as well, have a DP and a P2. Yeah.
Well, they got two DPs, right?
They run one full time.
The O1 and the O2.
They run the O2 only on select occasions.
Okay.
Yeah, like Daytona and such.
Okay.
Normally,
because they always have the.
Normally, their driver lineup is Mimo Rojas and. It's Mimo Rojas and Scott Pruitt.
Right, and they're in the O1. Hi to his family.
You typically hear them referred to as the star car for the second car.
Yeah, it's I know one time it was Dixon and Franchitti.
Well, that's what it was for Daytona, right?
Partly, yeah. I mean, they had Dixon, Franchitti, Montoya, and McMurray.
Well, what team was?
No. It was Dixon, Franchitti, McMurray, and Joey Hayden. Kimball was on the main team with.
With Pruitt and Rojas.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Kanaan's options for 2014, he's looking at the fourth seed in Ganassi. He's got a seat back with KV open. There's the Panther seat. He's got a lot of options on the table.
Is Panther really an option for Kanaan?
I would think that that's a bad option for Kanaan. I think we all think that Panther seat. The only thing you can do in that Panther seat is possibly finish second at Indy.
Yeah, and be frustrated as hell for the rest of the season.
Yeah, indeed.
And Kanaan wants to drive an Indy car bad enough, okay. But you know, really, I can't help but think that it'd be better to go to a successful sports car team than go to a mediocre Indy car team and end up just sucking ass.
It depends on what your objectives are, really, I guess.
Well, and how much you're paying, I suppose, but yeah, I see the Panther ride paying a whole heck of a lot.
There's some upsides to Panther. You go to Panther, you might have a potential shot at a stadium truck ride, or potentially you own an NASCAR seat, too. I mean, everything's fine. The doors are wide open at Panther.
Hey, he could be driving in X Games Rallycross next year.
That's true. That's true.
I think he would do well.
Maybe put him in Gymkhana Grid or something like that.
Yeah, I think he would. Well, you saw what he did with that Port-a-John.
Yeah.
and recall, he's one of the only IndyCar drivers who had the balls to go out to Tony Stewart's little playground and drive.
Oh, yes, that's right. Drove to Eldora with the
night before the dream or whatever they call it. Prelude to the dream.
The prelude to the dream. All right.
Late model race.
Next thing we got coming up, Dallara has decided that they are going to opt out of the Indy Aero Kit production to absolutely no one's surprise.
No.
Yeah. Well, what incentive is there for them?
None.
Zero.
Well, it's like the good folks at Dallara have already said that Chevy teams are going to have to run Chevy body kits. Honda teams are going to have to run Honda body kits. What good is there in a Dallara body kit?
Yeah. You know, there isn't. And
well, and then beyond that, the Chevy teams running Chevy body kits are going to be subsidized by Chevy. Not that they're going to get them for free, but Chevy has to spend a whole lot more money producing those body kits than they can charge the teams for.
Well, remember the analysis that we worked up, this is a couple years ago now.
Yeah, it's been a while.
You know, because the body kits are restricted in price, right? They're price cap.
Well, back then they were. We don't know what they're right now.
This is true.
Yeah.
And they could change the rules and they might end up not even happening, so who knows.
Speaking of already happening, AJ Allmendinger returns to Penske for the Fontana race. Hopefully is going to get a little redemption from his 200-yard showing at Detroit. And that's over both races, by the way.
Turn one wall. Look at it's Scott Sharp all over again.
Oh, yeah, that's about right.
I'd rather be Scott Sharp than Roberto Guerrero, though.
Yeah, at least Scott Sharp went out after the green.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, no, I think coming back on an oval, especially a big oval, is the smarter return for him. How long has it been since Dinger has actually run a street race?
Detroit.
Before the debacle at Detroit.
Long Beach.
Was he at Long Beach this year?
Yep.
Yeah, he was.
Okay, so before this year, before his return to Indycar, he didn't do any in NASCAR. I mean, he ran up in Montreal in Nationwide, didn't he?
Yeah, he ran. Yeah.
But that's not quite a street circuit. It's kind of like Melbourne. It's a park circuit. And so, you know, the last time that he ran a street circuit would have been back when he was in Atlantics, I think.
Kart?
He did a little stint in kart, didn't he, before he moved to NASCAR.
Pretty successful in kart, and obviously it was the one that got away, everybody felt, for the whole IndyCar side. But I'm sure he's quite happy with the money he made in NASCAR.
Oh, sure.
It allowed afforded him expensive habits.
Yeah. All right.
Some mistakes you just can't get away from, man.
No.
Now let's get into some safety issues that have come up recently. IndyCar has announced that they are moving to aluminum steering arms after a survey they did with the drivers about wrist and hand injuries. Also leading to talk about IndyCar also potentially adding power steering for the future. Now, Mike Shaw, I know you in particular were following this pretty closely. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, well, it's just something, you know, happened to catch at the last event. Jan Bikas really went into detail on this. And, that survey, they looked at all the different hand injuries and wrist injuries in the last couple of years. And literally every driver but three has had some sort of injury. In the last couple of years, hand or wrist injury. And so they're really looking at finding a way to clamp that down. And so the short-term solution right now was to change out the steering arms to be made of aluminum instead of the steel that they're made out of right now. So that way something else would break before the energy would transfer up to the hands and the steering wheel. I mean, that's definitely a step in that direction, but ultimately what this might lead to is, an electronic assist power steering. They don't want to go with a traditional power steering. They'd want to go the electric route, I guess, from what I was hearing. And I don't know. That's a technology that's definitely advanced quite a bit, especially you see it on the road cars today. But I don't know. It's one of the things that I like the traditional not having any power steering. I think that's one of the things that made IndyCar different from other open wheel races. I mean, it is a hell of a workout. If anybody here has ever driven a car without power steering and how hard it is to turn those cars at slow speed.
Oh, yeah.
And let alone when you got other forces against you. I mean, these guys have to be so fit to be able to turn these cars around. Power steering makes it quite easy, actually.
Parallel park a 1969 Chevy station wagon.
Yeah, exactly. I remember driving, one of the first cars I drove as a kid. My brother had a Honda CRX, and that thing had no power steering. And it was a fun little nimble car.
Well, I was going to say, that's what you get out and you fold it up, put it in your pocket, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a tiny little car, but, he had these, 50-15s, low-profile tires on it that, were pretty wide for the little thing. And let me tell you, when you're parallel parking that thing and you're trying to turn that steering wheel, it was definitely a challenge. But, it's just one of those things that I appreciate the safety concerns that they're coming up with and whatnot and trying to find a weakness, definitely by doing the different parts being aluminum. I don't know if I want to see power steering in IndyCar, though. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I'm go with you on that with the power steering because if you recall, when Danica was moving her way over into NASCAR, NASCAR, and a bunch of the yokels down in NASCAR land were like, oh, she'd never make it. She's not fit enough. She can't drive one of these big old tank cars. They're too heavy for her, blah, blah, blah.
They got power steering, bub.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The response was very resounding. You've got power steering.
And a bigger steering wheel.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm okay with the electronic assist power steering. Just so long as it's not electric steering. You know, a steer-by-wire type of system. Because then, oh, hell, just give him a game controller. You know, put a PS2 pad in front of him. But, you know, if it's a proper mechanical linkage so they can still feel the road, just a little easier on the loading, but you still have the tactile feel. I'd be okay with that. I'd be quite all right with that. And I really like the idea of making the steering assemblies weaker than the driver's arms. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, I don't really see it as a bad thing. Especially when you're talking a driver safety issue, and there have been a lot of injuries to the wrist lately. I remember that part that Mike's talking about where Jan Beekes was talking about it, and one thing that they showed was James Jake's crash at Toronto as well, and how Jake's, it was just by the grace of God that his hands got knocked off of the steering wheel before he hit the wall, or else he would have had the same injury that Briscoe had.
You know, but at least in the oval races, the guys tend to know, you know, I'm going near the wall, let go, right? I see more and more with the street and road courses, they still try and hold on to the wheel to the last moment.
Well, it happens so rapidly.
Yeah, typically on an oval, you know when it's letting go, but on an oval, man, it happens just like nothing. I mean, it's just so quick.
And even if it is slow developing, you sitting there in your head, I can save this, I can save this, and all of a sudden... Bam! No, you can't. And snap. So it's a very different, dynamic on a street circuit versus an oval.
And when you're talking a series, where your yearly budget is $6 to $8 million for most teams, the $20,000 for a power steering unit that they're talking about is not a bad deal.
No, not bad at all.
Yeah, it's still not going to stop them.
I think we'll see more driving, kind of like Formula One, you know, where the guys are really kind of hanging it out and the tires will get burned up a little more, I think, with power steering.
I think that's pretty interesting.
They're going to be able to easily, you know, you'll be able to muscle that car around a little more, you know, with the assist to, you know, keep it from stepping out on you too much.
And then the other thing is you lose some of the feel of the car when you go into power steering.
That's true.
Which you would lead to
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, which would lead to, like you said, burning up the tires quicker.
Well, okay, and this is why I mentioned that I hope it's an electronic assist and not just by wire type thing. You do lose some, but you do still have that feel. But I mean, if you start burning up tires more, hey, maybe we bring Pirelli into IndyCar after they leave Formula One.
Yeah.
So the next event we got coming up, gentlemen, it's August 25th at Sonoma. We're a couple of weeks away from that. We've got testing going on in Sonoma right now as well. And one name that we haven't talked about that's there with them is Lucas Lure. Lucas Lure is going to be driving a second car for Sarah Fisher at Sonoma as well. Gents, what do y'all think about the upcoming race at Sonoma?
Well, if I remember right, you guys call it Snoroma, right?
Yes.
We can't call it Infinayon anymore.
No, we can't.
Six beers but, point.
Yeah, you know, that's how I'll always remember that circuit, is as Sears Point. But you know, it's a remarkable circuit for sports car racing, for club racing, for motorcycles. But for Indy cars, it's tough. It's fun to watch them circulate, but the racing action is pretty anemic.
We always called it Six Beers Point because that was how many it took to make the racing interesting.
That's how I feel about NASCAR at Kansas.
Kansas Speedway?
Yeah.
Kansas, nice. Now, I will say this. I remember it seems like De Silvestro, Simona has done really well there. So maybe that'll be a good kickback into her driving is over there at Snorroma.
Simona's had some good runs there. Ryan Briscoe's had some excellent runs there. Ryan Hunter Ray's had some good runs. Will Power, when he's not getting T-boned, has had some good runs there. You might remember that Sears, what's it called now? Sonoma is the track where Will Power had that season-ending injury in his first season when he got speared by... Who was it that speared him again? Was it Servia?
No, it was really nice hair. I can't remember his name.
Matos?
No.
Marias?
No. Dang it, I can't remember
nice
his
hair.
I know it wasn't Saavedra.
No, I'll look it up and fill you in. I just can't remember who it was.
Sonoma crash. This is compelling radio right here, people. Nelson Philippe.
Thank you. He had really nice hair.
Yeah, I just found a video of that. Nothing like going sideways right in the middle of the racing line on a blind corner.
Yeah, a little rough there.
So, what if you had to make a pick right now of a winner for that race, who would you say?
Whoever watched the F1 race in the morning and didn't tune in for the IndyCar race.
Interesting. I would have to say that the winner is going to be whoever finishes first.
Excellent.
Such genius insight, sir.
Hey, that's why they pay me the big bucks.
This is our 200th episode. We got to pull out all the stops.
Okay.
And speaking of all the stops, let's make a stop in the world of Mazda Road to Indy. Where
yes,
Jay
yes,
Douglas Patterson, the 25th, wasn't here to wrap up Mid-Ohio for us.
Yeah, every first Tuesday of the month, we have our meeting for the Kansas City region of the SCCA, and so I was there at the meeting. Next week or next month, I actually will be here because will I? I might not. The first week of September is the Solo Nationals up in Lincoln, Nebraska. And I may be heading up there on Tuesday to enjoy, the wonderful sound of daily drivers being tortured half to death. Anyway, we'll see. But yeah, sorry I wasn't here, last week to enjoy the Mid-Ohio love fest that sounded like you all had, and the Mazda Road to Indy. Of course, the entire program was there this year. We've had bits and pieces of it before, but this year we had USF 2000 Pro Mazda and Indy Lights. The Indy Lights ran one, Pro Mazda ran two, and USF 2000 ran three. Triple header. And I tell you what, the USF 2000 race, that was there's been a serious change. Well, not a change, but a derailment, let me say, of Albarico's quest to kind of redeem himself from his fall at St. Petersburg and Sebring. Of course, Albarico starts out the season starting out very fast, but ended up DNFing in race one, winning race two, but then DNFing race three at St. Petersburg and in 20th, not a good finish in race two at St. Petersburg. So we thought, that's it. He's done. You know, Hargrove had three wins and in a P2. He was solidly in the championship lead. But then all of a sudden, Albarico comes comes back and wins the night before the 500 at Lucas Oil Raceway, wins the first race at Toronto, a race in which Hargrove struggled, finished out of the top 10. Albarico finished behind Hargrove in the second race at Toronto, a P5 to Hargrove's P2, but still kept in contact. Mid-Ohio Hargrove had a rough first race, finishing back in P7, or I'm sorry, P17. Albarico, by the way, hit the, he got the hat trick. Man, I've only had one rum and it's showing. I'm stuttering all over the place. Sorry about that, folks. But anyway, he gets most laps led, fastest race lap, and starts from pole and gets the win. All four. And on in race two, he also comes away with the win. But in race two, Hargrove is right on his heels, finishing P2. I do need to give a shout out to our good friend Peter Portante of Ballardi Auto Racing. He had a podium finish, a nice finish there in the Lucas Oil Raceway the night before the 500, which having a strong oval background, we were happy to see, but not surprised to see. Had a good finish at Toronto P4, but in race two at Mid Ohio, he put in a masterful drive and found the podium once again. So he's up there on the podium with a third place finish in race two at Mid Ohio. Great drive, and was looking to try and repeat it, if not best it, in race two. Until it all went horribly, horribly wrong. Coming to the start, it had been moist that morning. coming down towards the start-finish line, of course, the start line, which, of course, is on the back straight, right, there at Mid-Ohio. Going downhill, Albarico guns the gas, spins the car, and collects 11 other competitors. 11 other competitors. So fully over a third of the grid out before they even get to the green flag, before they even get to the start line. It was a mess, and it took forever to get everybody cleaned up. But it took out not just Albarico, but it also took out Danilo Estrella, who Estrella had. This is an event he wants to forget. it's funny. He says, I don't like the oval racing, but he did well at Lucas Oil. He says, I love the natural terrain road courses. Three DNFs in a row. And it's not for lack of speed. The kid was fast all weekend, and it just could not bring the car home. Florian Latorre, Peter Portante, Jesse Lazare, Jason Wolf, Dalton Kellett, Daniel Burkett. You notice the proliferation of Ballardi Auto Racing drivers that got knocked out. Slagecki and Michael Johnson, JDC Motorsport driver, was also knocked out, as well as Tim Paul. They all had DNFs as a result of Albarico's goosing the gas early on. But that opened the door for Garrett Grist, who made a great pass on Scott Hargrove to take the lead. And Hargrove came in second, securing much-needed points. Now he goes to Laguna Seca with 227 points to Albarico's 181. So 46 points, the difference between Albarico and Hargrove with four races left. I tell you, I think at this point, this is Hargrove's championship to lose. If he can keep the consistency up, there's no way Albarico's going to catch up to him. There's no way he's going to touch him. So, Mike, what did you think of the USF 2000 races, or were you too deep in your cherries?
I would say I was deep in my cherries and displaying ambivalence.
Oh, you know, that's unfortunate because there are some great battles. I remember watching the race two, which was in the wet. It wasn't raining, but it had just rained. The track was still extremely wet, and there were some great racing. I was camped out there at the exit of Thunder Valley as cars came over crest and down into the in the carousel. And yeah, it's unfortunate, man, because they were doing some great racing out there. but you had cherries.
I admit I was more enamored with other things.
Kevin, did you get to see the broadcast? No, they haven't broadcast the Mid Ohio yet, have they?
I watched Kevin, the lot. Yeah, I watched the lots race, but I didn't get to see the USF 2000 Pro Mazda.
Well, I noticed that the USF 2000 Pro Mazda races are now being aired on NBC Sports Network.
Yep.
Wow.
I'm like, all right, this is cool. Of course, they're starting earlier in the season. But anyway, I'll keep an eye on it. I'll track down a schedule and I'll post it as soon as the semester gets started up and I get things kind of squared away in a schedule underneath me. But I'll post that up for folks. But yeah, the Mid-Ohio races were really good. I thoroughly enjoyed them. And, you know, like many of these races, don't just pay attention to who's in front. Pay attention to all the battles that are happening throughout the grid. There's some really fantastic racing going on. Pro Mazda. It wouldn't have changed the outcome of the championship. But Diego Ferreira should have had his second win of the season at Mid Ohio, and Brabham will be the first to admit that. He'll be the first to say that. Yeah, should have gone to Diego. What had happened is in race two there was a very late yellow, but it didn't come out quite fast enough. Oil was laid down on the track, and Ferreira had slipped on it and went off course. Brabham went around, slipping on the oil as well, but kept it on course just barely. Brabham, seeing the yellow flag, tried to back up and give Diego the position back, but was ordered back to P1. So it was an uncomfortable podium. But the race number one, that was all Brabs. It was just a straight-up masterful drive. And this past weekend at the Trois-Rivières, Matthew Brabham mathematically clinched the Pro Mazda Championship. And, well, how could he not? He broke not just the single season win record, which was set by Jack Hawksworth of last year, but he also broke the all time win record that was set by Peter Dempsey. And so he has now 10 wins? Let me count here real quick. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 wins. Did I count that right? I did. 11 wins. So just, you talk about a dominating season.
Can we rename the series to the Matthew Brabham Invitation?
Yeah. That's what it should have been, huh? I tell you what. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what he does in Houston. I, for one, hope he doesn't pull a Hawksworth and sit out. If you remember, Hawksworth backed out of the car when they went to Road Atlanta, said, "No, I've got the championship. I'm done. I don't need to risk it anymore." From a business standpoint, from a monetary standpoint, I get that. But from a racer standpoint, it is totally foreign to me. How are you not in the car when you have the opportunity? So I'm hoping that Brabham will be in a car in Houston, or if he's not in a Pro Mazda car, I want to see him in a lights car. But anyway, so we have Houston left on the schedule, and that's it. Diego has pretty firm grip on P2, and the only battle left is between Shelby Blackstock and Spencer Piggott. They're duking it out for third in the championship, and there's only 8 points separating those two. And so that's it. That's a wrap on the Pro Mazda series. I'm really excited to see where Pro Mazda is going to go next year, as the series becomes Andersonized, I guess you might say. I really hope we see the car counts come back up a little bit.
Yeah, I think he's definitely the key there.
So, thoughts on the Pro Mazda action?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll have to wait to be able to tune into it. I haven't seen it, but it sounded like there was some great stuff that was going on there.
And Mike,
that's a great track for it, too. Yeah.
Yes. I did watch the Indy Lights race. Don't
Well, that was an interesting race.
Carlos Munoz is muy loco.
No, Carlos Munoz, I tell you what, that was maybe a little ill-advised move. I don't know. But he went off course.
It was questionable at worst.
Yeah, and it was you could say, did Hawksworth block him? I don't know. I'm not going to call what Hawksworth did blocking.
I wouldn't call it a block. I wouldn't say it was a bad move by Munoz. It was just one of those things that just didn't work out.
Yeah, Hawksworth defended well, and I think that's what it comes down to. And anyway, so Munoz goes off course all the way to the back of the grid, right? And it was amazing seeing him fight his way through, slicing and dicing back through the cars. He ended up finishing fourth in the race after being stuck back in 11th. Yes, 11. There were three more cars this time. We have Matthew DeLeo back at the Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course in Indy Lights. He had run Long Beach and Toronto before that. So it's good to see him. Good to see him have reasonable speed. You know, I'm not going to say he was threatening to pass anybody, but he looked like he was getting more comfortable with the car.
He looks solid.
Yeah, and of course all of this is in preparation for a full effort next year, right?
Yes, yes.
This is just a period where he's trying to put all the pieces together, figure out the race car, figure out the engineering of the car, and so yeah. And Bilardi had a third driver, Giancarlo Serinelli.
Yep.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah.
Serinelli.
Yeah.
And he was slow. I mean, I always try to find something nice or a positive way. Giancarlo wasn't in the way. He got out of the way when people were coming by, but God, he was slow. You know, maybe he picks it up and figures it out. In a future race, but this wasn't his race. This wasn't Karam's race either.
Oh,
what
he was there?
Up with Sage.
He was there?
Sorta. Out for a Sunday drive, it looked like. And excuse me. I know that Sage can be fast on natural terrain road courses. The ovals are, I think, where he does his best work in the Formula cars, but his first win did come at Toronto last year, right? In the Pro Mazda series, or Star Mazda as it was then. And so it's not like he doesn't know how to drive twisties really fast, but last 2 weeks, and especially this, or the last two events, and especially the Mid-Ohio event, man, Just couldn't get the setup figured out, and it was just it's a brutally long weekend for the kid. It was hard to watch.
Doug, to follow,
it's one of those things. You know he's got the speed, but he just couldn't put it together.
Hey, Doug, to follow up on Serinelli a little bit, I just looked him up. He is currently in the GP2 series, actually. He races for Venezuela GP Lazarus.
Okay, and he finished sitting in 20 what?
He finished 33rd last year.
Okay.
He has also done Auto GP, the Latam Challenge, Formula 2000 de America, Euro Cup, Formula Renault 2, Italian Formula Renault 2, and Formula Ford Venezuela.
Okay.
He's the 2008, 2010, 2011 Latam Challenge Series champion, 2000, 2002 Formula Ford Venezuela champ. He's actually a Venezuelan driver.
Yeah. Goncalves. They both have the same Venezuela sponsorship on the side of their car. And Goncalves is a great kid. But I don't foresee Goncalves advancing beyond Indy Lights. And Serinelli, man, unless he brings more game, he's not advancing in... he's not advancing in Indy Lights either. And, you know, I will say that, you know, there, I think a lot of their money comes from, we would have called it Hugo Bucks before, right?
Yeah.
But when you look at the drivers that EJ Viso is backing, Diego Ferreira, you know, and not... You know, you don't see Team Viso on the side of Goncalves' car or on Serinelli's car.
Right.
And there's probably a good reason for that.
And one other driver that started at Mid-Ohio that I'd like to mention real quick is Axel Jeffries. He was in the Brian Herta entry, and that actually leads into one of our other topics that we've got here.
He actually had a reasonable outing. You know... He finished P7, but he looked good out there. He looked racy. And I think keep in mind that he was with Brian Herta, right?
Yeah. Who hasn't won a lots race in 2 years.
Right. And when they did, it was sketch.
They won races.
They did on occasion.
They won several races. They won with Daniel Harrington. They won with Sebastian Saavedra.
They did win with Sebastian Saavedra, but you'll also remember Saavedra split that team because of some issues with the car and how the car was engineered. The Herta Autosport team would take down a win every now and then, they were in no danger of challenging for the championship. So given the fact that they were a mid-pack team to begin with and that they've been away for a while, I look at Axel Jeffries' performance and I'm very impressed with it.
Oh, he did a great job. And that also leads into another topic. You know, we've got Herta that's looking to come back to the Lot Series next year, actually.
Well, you know, he's not the only one. There's actually quite a few that I think we'll see come back to Indy Lights. I think we'll see Team E perhaps come back to run lights. Of course, DeLeo will be there. I think I wouldn't be surprised to see Juncos Racing come back with a car or two as the conditions improve, as the environment improves in Indy Lights.
Now, here's another reason why I think Herta would be coming back, and that is there are two drivers kind of into the latter series right now that I know they have an interest in. One of them, his name last name is Herta, and the other one, his last name is Newey.
That could Well, we'll see how that goes. We'll see how that goes. I mean, yeah, you like to give your kid a ride, but once you get up to lights, you know, it's not chump change that you're talking about.
No.
Now, Newey's done pretty well. He had a nice sixth place finish here in race three at Mid Ohio. He's done fairly well.
I want to say Colton Herta is still doing karting, isn't he?
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to ask if he was in 1600s yet, or doing the Skip Barber thing.
Yeah, I think he's doing Skippy right now.
Okay. Yeah, because I would have remembered hearing about him in USF 2000. And I remember hearing about Brandon. But anyway, so, yeah, there's... Even if you take the family thing away, okay, even if you remove that, I think there's a lot of incentive for a lot of teams to return to the series. I think we'll see Team Moore come back with a solid two-car team again instead of the one and maybe a second every now and then that they've been forced to run this year. I don't know. I think we'll see at least a 30% increase in car count. I think we'll be in the low teens, if not mid teens.
Very good. Is that all we have for Mazda Road to Indy this week?
That's it. I do want to say on the SCCA front,
nobody cares.
We had Sean will. Sean will listen to every damn word I have to say.
No, he won't, because he won't even show up. What was that picture that we posted again?
Yep, that coward bailed on me. Left, someone had asked to co-drive my car. I'm like, no, I can't, man. Sean said he's in for the rest of the season. He's going to do this. And I'm sitting there looking like a fool on Sunday morning. He's like, where's Sean? I thought you said he was going to drive your car. I'm like, I thought so, too. I must have scared him off. I don't know. But anyway, so the season continues. We got a bunch of guys going up to nationals. Jeremy Salinas is going up to both compete in nationals, and he's going to take all my camera gear, or a lot of my camera gear, and photograph the event for us as well. So look for some good coverage of the solo nationals coming up here in a couple weeks.
Excellent. Excellent. Now it's on to the world of Formula One. Mike Watzel, are you with me? Valencia in talks to break F1 contract. Absolutely no one weeps.
Too many cherries.
I thought that was a bad idea.
No. Valencia, I hate to say it, nobody is weeping for you. Nobody. The only thing that is sad about this is Valencia is in talks with F1's chief executive to try and defray the full 33 million euro termination penalty for the contract. If you're talking about a $33 million termination penalty, why don't you just run the dang race? That's how much it costs. and that's why Bernie locks in these long contracts with these escalators. You know, it's like a 10% escalator on the fee every year, and then also throws in draconian cancellation fees. Just so he can guard against tracks who, like Valencia, have decided this is too costly for us to continue. We're not making the return on investment that we hoped. So now we have to deal with Bernie, who's going to soak us for money and replace us with the race anyway.
So, yeah, exactly. The only cool thing about Valencia is the bridge that you kind of don't know is there.
Yeah, that bridge, that's all, it's like the only reason they made it a 9.5 mile street course race, or however long that ridiculous track is. It's just awful. 26 corners on a street track is absolute garbage. But the sad thing is Barcelona has known this for quite a while. They had been selling tickets already for next year's race, even though it was supposed to be at Valencia. Through the contract, it was supposed to be at Valencia. But they knew well in advance, and they've already been selling tickets for next year's race. And Valencia even said, hey, what's up? Why are you doing this? And Barcelona just responded, go talk to Bernie. So nobody's weeping for the death of Valencia. We just hope that other tracks would just die a quick death too, like, you know, Korea or Hungaroring. But unfortunately, that one's not going away.
The Hungaboring?
Hungaboring. The hang me, it's so boring ring. But the only other, a couple other things going on in F1, and one is you've got all these stories popping up in the media, and most of it's like, well, we asked so-and-so what they thought about F1 currently, and they said blah, you know, so what? Doesn't really matter. There was a little bit of a tempest and a not really a tempest, but some talk about this Rush movie that's upcoming. And Ron Howard, you know, basically said that they really didn't have any involvement from FOM in this movie, mainly because they picked something in 1970s, you know, the 1970s. The modern era of F1 kind of started, FOM's management of F1 started in 81. FOM owns the broadcast rights to all footage from 81 forward. They own nothing before that. So that's part of the reason that they picked before 81 to tell a story. Very little involvement from the existing F1 teams, because what can they offer? Nothing really. For the most part, they got help from historic Grand Prix enthusiasts, and that was pretty much it. So, while Bernie may have liked to have a movie about modern era F1, nobody's willing to pay him to do it. And the unfortunate thing is, you know, this movie's going to come out, and it's going to point back to the glory days of F1, kind of like we all, you know, sit on track form and gripe about how we prefer it be, you know, front engine and why do they have wings and where's your Offenhauser?
Formula One should run at DuQuoin and and Eldora.
Exactly. And... It's unsafe without a riding mechanic.
Indeed. So it's kind of an interesting thing, because it's kind of the same thing, the same kind of a fan of F1 is the one that's really getting their bread buttered by this movie. It will be interesting to see if it really has a blip on F1 ratings in the United States, because it's actually pointing to an era that's long past, and the cars are, you can't look at a modern era F1 car and compare it with the James Hunt car and see any real similarities. The only other thing going on in F1 is Sauber. Sauber is, Pirelli's still waiting for Sauber to pay their tire bill. And, well, as soon as that money came in from that Russian team, they were going to pay that tire bill. But, yeah.
Can we pay you in chocolate and wristwatches?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it goes, because the 17-year-old Sergei Sirotkin will not be driving for Sauber next year, because his dad has officially pulled out of the deal. The Russian sponsor Rescue has failed. So
his dad grounded him, in other words.
Yes.
No F1 for you.
That's it, boy. You're going to GP2. No!
But Dad!
Keep giving me lip and you're going to World Series by Renault.
Jeez.
God help me, I'll send you to...
We were planning on going to Monaco for vacation this fall, but instead I think we'll just go to the Azores.
Yeah. Next coming up for Formula One, August 25th, it's Spa. It's awesome. I mean, what else can you say about Spa, but it's awesome.
Yes.
It's on my bucket list.
Yeah, indeed. Spa, August 25th. Sonoma, August 25th. Rally Deutschland wraps up on August 25th. There's some good stuff there.
Yeah, it's going to be
two out of three ain't bad.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
And that was an awesome segue, by the way.
I know how to fix Sonoma, though.
Blow it up.
Hinkelsteins.
Oh, yeah, put a few of those stones out there, and that'll make it very interesting. Huh?
What would happen if Hermann Tilke redesigned Sonoma?
Nothing. It would look exactly the same.
This track is good, yeah?
A stadium section, maybe.
We take out the
turns. You got to have the stadium there around the carousel, right?
Yeah.
Indeed. They'd have to level out that that blind uphill corner, though, because that just can't that can't be on a Hermann Tilke track.
See, that's the most that's my favorite thing about that circuit is that the two blind apex overcrest corners, those are tricky corners.
Yeah,
I think my favorite.
Yeah.
My favorite part of that track is the downhill leftward sweeper onto the dragway. That's just a beautiful turn.
Yeah. Yes.
Say what we will about how boring Sonoma can be as a track. It's a pretty
drive
place.
Drive it is something completely different.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
To watch a race there is one thing, but to drive it, and boy, yeah, that's there's a lot of push on that downward corner. Yeah. It's not easy.
But it holds nothing. To Spa. Oh, Spa. It's right. The granddaddy of all road courses.
Speaking of Spa, you know who's driven at Spa? Robert Kubica. And now he's in the running for a full-time World Rallycross drive. Tell me about that, Mike Shaw.
That would be World Rally Championship drive, not Rallycross.
It's the same thing.
No, not.
What, they both drive little hot hatch grocery getters?
I'll give you a little bit of that. Okay.
Nice.
So what's going on with Robert?
Robert Kubica. Yeah, I mean, the guy's amazing, right? I mean, he was in Formula One, and then he had his massive injury a couple of years ago with the rally he did in Italy. And, you know, as he's healed up, he's not quite ready for F1, but he's gotten a ride with Citroën already. With the WRC2, which is the normally aspirated, he's driving the RRC, which is a regional rally car, as they call it, which is basically just a step down from the WRC top class cars, less carbon fiber on it, a little bit bigger restrictor on the turbo, so it performs equal to what was called the S2000 cars. And he's been doing very well in that championship and very well could take the championship this year. He's definitely a leader in the points, and he's just an amazing driver. He had never driven on gravel or raced on gravel until just a few months ago, his first gravel rally event. And he just automatically just dominated until he hit a rock and, you know, had some punctures and stuff that he didn't put enough spares in his car because he wasn't used to the punctures and stuff that you can get with gravel rallies. But he learned a lot, learned real quick, and he's a damn fast driver. He outdid Hayden Padden over at Rally Finland, and Hayden, he's known for when he just dominated in the production series stuff 2 years ago, and so very, very fast driver, and you can't help but you know, look at Yves Matton, who's the team principal for Citroën, and Mikko's not performing very well. And Danny Sordo has just been lackluster also so far this season. And here you've got Chris Meek, who enters in and does extremely well at Finland to cover for Abdulaziz, is that it was? Whoever there, that the Abu Dhabi team driver is there that he ended up replacing for that one event. And so you've got these young drivers that are just making these experienced guys look slow. So I think there's definitely a possibility there that Kubica could end up taking either Mikko's seat or Danny Sordo's seat next year if he ends up winning that championship. Yves Matton has said that it's not something they're talking about, but it's possible. And again, thinking of the lackluster careers so far, or season so far for Mikko and Sordo, it's looking more and more like there's going to be some replacements on that team. So yeah, that kind of segues into Chris Meek. Even though Chris Meek crashed out on the penultimate stage at Finland, his performance was so good. He was in fifth place for most of the rally, and he was more than 30 seconds faster than Danny Sordo for much of the rally, and just really good commitment, much faster. And so he got rewarded with the fact that he gets to actually replace Sordo for Rally Australia. That's not a huge surprise, considering that Meek has a lot more experience on gravel. Sordo used to be, back in the day, they used to have the specialist drivers that would come in, and they'd drive the tarmac rallies, because there weren't as many tarmac rallies as the gravel rallies. And now you kind of got these well-rounded drivers that just drive everything. Sordo is more of a tarmac driver, and so to see Meek go over to Australia and race in the gravel round there, that kind of makes sense, and he deserves the opportunity for sure. Yeah, I think Sordo's days are numbered. If he doesn't perform really well at the upcoming German round, I think his career in WRC is pretty much done. So really, yeah, that's the big news is Citroën. It's Meek and Kubica likely to maybe become the two key players there. I don't know. Mikko might be able to hold on for a little bit longer. Sordo's probably more likely to go first because he just hasn't had that spark. Except for maybe in the tarmac. We might see something happen there. Mikko, on the other hand, he's mostly a gravel guy. So now that we go into the tarmac rounds, what's going to happen to Mikko Hirvonen? If he doesn't at least perform okay, you know, yeah, like I said, he could be done as well. That's where I expect to see Kubica do that much better, because obviously coming from Formula One, he knows tarmac even better than he knows gravel. So that's going to be impressive to see there. In other news, we do have a new tire manufacturer showing up for WRC next year, and that's Pirelli. So maybe they're just saying, you know what, forget you guys in the Formula One. We'll go to where things are a little bit more comfortable over in the WRC.
Weren't they there once before?
They were, actually. Last I remember, when the Subaru was in it, they were one of the tire manufacturers supporting Subaru. I remember Subaru being pretty frustrated at the time because the tires were heavier. They wouldn't get punctures, but they had such a strong construction that they were super heavy, and drivers were complaining about that. But yeah, Michelin's become the dominant player there, and well, really the only player there, except really over the last couple of years, there's been a little bit of a transition. We now already have not just Michelin, but you still got D-Mac out there. And Hankook is also a player in WRC. So Pirelli is just going to be one of four tire manufacturers now. So I don't know what to really think of that. I mean, just pick your tire, I guess. I like the idea of the competition between all the different tire manufacturers. That's great. But yeah, I don't think it's going to be something that Pirelli is going to like muscle their way in and just suddenly go to the top. I think they'll just be an also-ran. I think Michelin will still be the top tire for now. FIA is really close with the French manufacturers, of course. So, yeah. So here. Next up for the WRC is, of course, the Rally Deutschland, that August 22nd through the 25th, as Weitzel is saying. And that is an awesome, awesome race, and I can't wait for that one. It is a great way to start off the tarmac rounds, and like you said, Hinkelsteins. That's all you have to say right there. That one word explains Rally Germany. They got to be so careful when they go on the, I think it's called the Bumholder. They go out on the military range, and you get those long sweeping corners that if you step out a little bit too far, those stones are waiting for you. And it's not just that the rock sit, you know, these concrete things stick up out of the ground. What you're seeing sticking out of the ground by about, what are they, about 2 feet tall? Mm-hmm. That's only 1/4 of the size of the stone. The rest of it's underground. That's how strong they are.
Installed as a tank deterrent.
Exactly. And that's the whole entire point of those, is to keep the tanks on the road if they get out of control, or they kind of bump into them, and keep them on track. So, very dangerous place to things get out of line. What also makes Germany interesting is the weather can be a little interesting. They're right in the hillsides there, and, you know, it's kind of – I know I'd equate it to like the monsoon seasons here we get over here in the U.S., where you get these spurts of rain that come through and then it dries up. So then you get some good fun with people playing tire choice games and figuring out what's going to work best. So very good event, and I would expect to see really good things, especially out of Thierry Neuville on that one. He's mostly a tarmac guy, and after what he showed us in Finland, boy, that kid could end up winning the next rally. So we'll have to see what happens there, but there aren't really that many that are majorly quick on the tarmac like Loeb was. Loeb was just a whole other level above everybody else on tarmac. Latvala was kind of catching. He was getting faster. So he's one to watch out for. Ogier, he's had good moments and bad moments. But Neuville, he loves the tarmac. The Belgian rallies, that he's from Belgium, and most of those are tarmac rounds, and he's just very quick on that stuff. So be exciting stuff to see. But if you're kind of bored and want while you're waiting for the rally coming up in Germany, I happen to notice that the full WRC episodes for what was in Finland, which is just great with all those yumps and jumps going on, they've had the full episodes of the coverage from Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, each one a half hour long on WRC.com. So check that out. Some great, great rally coverage that we normally don't get to see here in the U.S. So, and I hope that changes someday soon. Next up, also on that same weekend, we have the Rally America's next round, the Ojibwe Forest Rally. That's coming up August 23rd to the 24th. So again, everything kind of being piled up in that same weekend.
And I will say that we will have reports live from the event, well, pseudo live, from the manager of Poor Boys Racing and a newest member of the Open Paddock Photography team, Josh Tons. He's going to come out and photograph the Grand Am race here at Kansas. We're going to tag team that this coming weekend. And then, the weekend after that, he's taking his team Poor Boys Racing up to Minnesota, and he's going to do double duty as rally team manager and as reporter and photographer for Open Paddock. So looking forward to seeing not just reports on the rally action, but hopefully some insights as to what really goes on with a rally team over a rally weekend. Should be good stuff.
Yeah, that should be really good to see. And, you know, Ojibwe, it'll be a very interesting round for the top teams, too. I mean, this could be the championship decider for a number of different teams there. Ken Block pretty much has a win each round. The remaining two rounds, if he wants to win the championship. Higgins, if he gets second, and if you read my article that I posted about just a little review of what happened up at the New England one, it'd be just 1 point separating them, and Block could win the whole thing. So if Higgins wins, it's done. Higgins has the championship. If Block falters and breaks something, yeah, Higgins got it. So it all comes down really to just one point if Block wins it. Will he or won't he? I don't know. What I was hearing about with that round is it's a new one to the Rally America Championship. Well, not new. It's returning, I should say. I believe the last time they were there was 2009.
Well, it was a regional rally for a while, wasn't
it? For a few years, it was a regional rally because, yeah, they got dropped off the schedule. And so they've kept it up. A few new roads, but one thing I was hearing about it is that, you know, the roads are fast and they're sweeping, but there's like a tall grass on the sides of the roads that hide some pretty big rocks. So they got to be kind of careful with their corner cuts and whatnot. So might hear about a few punctures here and there or suspension damage. We'll find out what happens there. Also with the two-wheel drive championship, right now ACP leads that one. And again, you've got Brendan Reeves and Rhiannon Smythe, the Australians, that if they win the next two rounds, they could win the championship by 2 points in that one. Again, very close. And ACP needs to finish ahead of them. What'll be interesting in the two-wheel drive round is you have the wild card that is Will Orders in that GT86. If he's going to be competing, and if he ends up finishing ahead of either of those two and knocking their point scores down, then, you know, that could change the entire championship scope there. So some interesting math. You kind of have to figure out who's going to come out on top. But really, the bottom line is it has to be a double win for Reeves and for Block to come out. So we'll see what happens. A good round, though, and it's good to see that one back on the calendar, to see seven events instead of just six. And I hope to see Rally America expand even beyond that over the years. We'll see what happens next year. And then quick note on Global Rallycross was last weekend. I'm still trying to get into the sport. I will say that one thing that was great to see is Subaru's improved quite a bit. They made it to the podium twice in a row now, third spot. But it did show that they're competitive. Ford still dominate. We had the same podium as it was X Games at LA. It was Tuomas Häkkinen again. That's his fifth win in a row. Tanner Faust second. Sverre Isaacson in third. So the championship pretty much might as well be over. Häkkinen, I think he just has to finish one more race and he's won, or finish well in a heat and he's already got the championship. So way to go for the young Finnish kid, especially after last year breaking an ankle, slamming into the steel jump of death. And then Dodge, sad. I had hopes for the Dodge Dart being competitive because the car was built by the same guy that built the Fords. So the design was there, but they've been having some serious issues, both mechanical and driver-wise. The only person that seems to do well with that car has been Travis Pastrana, at least when he hasn't broken it. But yeah, if the car is running well, he's the only one that seems to finish well in it. So GRC, they got a few rounds left, and we'll see how it comes out on top. But certainly won't be Dodge, that's for sure. That's it for rally news.
So is anyone actually showing up to the GRC events?
You know, there's been a smattering of people. You know, obviously when they show it on the TV, they zoom in on just where they pack the people in.
The tens of people.
Yes, the tens of people. You know, just like with a lot of sports, though, the TV matters more than the attendance.
The fact
that they've got the TV deal, that matters a lot.
But not for the venues. Are they doing track rentals?
They'd have to be at this stage. I don't see. I mean, just they've got potential, but yeah, there's just not a lot of people there.
I kind of enjoy the Global Rallycross myself.
You know what was actually, in all honesty, what was the most fun to watch was the Supercar Lights. If you watch the event over the weekend, the Supercar Lights are the young kids that are in the equally matched cars. They're all the same exact design and setup. And there was a battle till the very end in that one. They especially between second and third, these guys were bumping into each other and losing bumpers and still going. And they changed places three times over 10 laps. And it was really, really fun to watch. And those guys really put everything into it. And the track was pretty good, too. A good amount of gravel there. The jump's kind of weak sauce these days with being the tabletop jump. But, you know, they have to just say they have a jump. Because that was their whole deal when they started the thing, when it used to be the gap jump. So, but, you know, it's very exciting, especially with the lower class stuff. But most of these rallycross events, it's one at the start. Who can get to that first turn first? If you can get into that first turn ahead of the other guy with that better reaction time, almost like a drag race, unless something breaks on your car, you're likely going to win it. That's kind of how it tends to turn out. There are a few cases where there's somebody being passed, but there just aren't that many laps. You know, you just got 10 laps to do it in. That's not a lot of room.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, too, I actually know a pretty good bit of people that went over to Atlanta for that race. And had it not been for some other things that came up, I would have definitely gone myself. But, I mean, it was... Like I said, I know a lot of people over... It's the Southeast, man. People just like racing.
So, did you get any feedback from them on what they thought of it?
I haven't talked to any of them yet, so...
All right. That'd be nice to kind of hear what it's like being at the event, you know, what the, kind of the atmosphere is like and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, I would hope that they take kind of from the rally type of side of things where people can easily get up close to the drivers and talk to them and whatnot versus... a lot of the other motorsports where the paddock's really closed off and good luck getting anywhere, you know, unless you got a press pass or something. So,
I'll get some feedback and report back to you.
Cool. Good to hear. Good to hear.
A couple other things we need to hit real quick. The USCR has announced that their TV deal is with Fox Sports, long-term deal to be spread out over Fox 1 and Fox 2.
Is that really surprising with their ties to NASCAR now?
Sort of, actually. Since you've got NASCAR that's going to NBC Sports Network.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Fox Sports isn't really... This last Sunday was the last episode of Wind Tunnel,
mm-hmm.
You know, and they're really cutting out a lot of their motorsports coverage. And so, yeah, it kind of is a surprise that they're going to be on Fox.
Yeah, but the other side is it may be part of the NASCAR deal. You will carry this and you'll get a cheaper rate or whatever.
Yeah.
pleasure of doing business with NASCAR is you get to... you get to have their programming. It's kind of like the NBA contracts that required you to have WNBA games mm-hmm. on your network as well. Kind of a weird situation, but they are going to continue MotoGP, if I remember right, as well on
Fox
and Sports 1.
And they're continuing the AMA Supercross.
Okay.
Which is also owned by Daytona, by the way.
Hmm.
So what happens to Speed?
Speed becomes Fox Sports 1 and Fuel becomes Fox Sports 2.
Interesting.
And Fox Sports 1 will make Speed like Speed was to Speed Vision.
And so Dave Despain goes away and probably pops back up on NBC Sports in about 6 months.
Think so?
I think so.
I think that kind of requires something in his wheelhouse, though, and I don't know if they're planning on doing any motorcycles.
I think they'd probably like to have a general motorsports show, though, since they're going to be having NASCAR, Formula One, and IndyCar, and the feeder series and everything.
Yeah, I mean, because Dave has been pretty much a shill for NASCAR for quite a while now with his program, unfortunately. That's just how it comes across because that's what everything really focused around on speed the last few years has been NASCAR. So
yeah, and when I mean when that's what your boss tells you that you're gonna do, then that's pretty much what you're gonna do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last bit of news: Pamela Anderson and Marcus Fuchs do not make a porno.
I hope that's how you pronounce his last name.
Exactly.
that's how I'm going to pronounce it for the sake of the non-explicit tag for this show.
Good job, sir.
They are not making a porn. They are making a new GT racing team.
Yeah, I just happened to spot this on Autosport, and I just couldn't help but laugh just a little bit. But yeah, I guess Canadian actress and model, as they're saying here, is joined forces with sometimes GT racer Marcus Fuchs, we'll say, to form Race Alliance by Pamela Anderson. So, but you know what? In all honesty, she's no stranger to investing in some actually pretty smart business things. As much as you want to say about the woman, she's actually a smart businesswoman. And so apparently the organization has moved out of its headquarters in from Austria to Germany and will be fielding a Ferrari 458 Italia in the final FIA GT rounds. And then apparently they have NASCAR on their agenda eventually that they'd like to do with this team. So yet another one of those USCAR GT things to keep an eye on, see what happens. But I found it fairly interesting. Not very often you see someone like Pamela Anderson joining into a racing team.
Exactly.
Yeah, indeed.
One note that I'd like to hit real quick that we didn't bring up on Indy Lights is there's a rumor going around that the new Indy Lights engine is going to be the Chevy Inline 4 Turbo.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So that's just something floating around right now.
Okay. So that's their new direct injection. Is that the 1.6 liter turbo, or is that going to be?
It's the 1.6 turbo. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that makes that architecture makes a lot of sense for that series.
It does.
Although I will say I'm a little bit surprised that it's a Chevy, not a Mazda, but. Okay, not a lot surprised, but a little bit.
And
I'm expected it to be a Mazda.
And I'm kind of surprised that if it wasn't the Mazda, that it wasn't the Ford. And the reason being because Ford owns so much of Mazda.
No, not anymore. They don't. During the one of the reasons why Ford didn't have to take public money is because they had so many other assets that they could sell off.
Right,
and they got rid of a lot of their Mazda interests gotcha. during that particular downturn. Ford has made statements that they are not interested in open wheel racing.
Okay, then Chevy's willing to jump right in. Then all right.
So does anybody have any other notes right now?
I think that about covers episode 200.
Good.
It was epic.
Yeah.
Epic
fail?
Epic show.
yeah, kind of a boring week. But everything's going to happen on the weekend of the 25th, so there you go. This is the build-up.
We got one more week of build-up, and then everything happens. So I guess that's going to do it. So, gentlemen, say good night.
Sayonara.
Right.
Au revoir.